The UN has confirmed a report that a top Saudi official made a death threat against a UN rapporteur in charge of a probe into the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Tehran says the Washington remains in breach of the JCPOA and a relevant UN resolution after a top U.S. diplomat said the ball is in Iran's court to revive the agreement. And Palestinian groups say that they have little hope for change in Tel Aviv's policies towards Palestinians following the latest Israeli elections. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, UN Human Rights Office has confirmed remarks by UN expert Agnes Callamard that she was threatened by Saudi officials for her role in Jamal Khashoggi's investigation. Now, Callamard said that a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her, quote, taken care of. UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary and Arbitrary Killing says officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. In a report published in June 2019, Callamard said the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's death constituted an extrajudicial killing for which Saudi Arabia is responsible. U.S. intelligence reports also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly approved and ordered the assassination of Khashoggi in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in late 2018. Just joining us out of Westchester, Pennsylvania, is Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer out of Westchester University. We can get it out. Hello, Larry. Hope you're safe and doing well. How's it going? Larry, this is crazy. It's like something you see out of one of the, Godfather movies, isn't it?
It's not far from that, is it? There are two rogue states in the Middle East. The two rogue states, Israel and Saudi Arabia, right? And they're rogue because they follow no laws. They follow no rational, internationally recognized procedures in terms of how they express themselves. And so that we all know that the leader of Saudi Arabia is a murderer. We all know that the leaders in Jerusalem are racists and have their own blood on their hands as well. The only country that can rein those two rogue states in is the United States, and it refuses to do it. And when it refuses to do it, it encourages them, both of those states. And this threat that was made against the UN official is a sign of that enablement, that they don't feel that they have anyone to answer to. No one can rein them in. And so they do this kind of barbaric kind of behavior.
Thank you, Larry. Stay safe, bud. It's always a pleasure. Always have a pleasure to have you on. Out of Westchester, Lawrence Davidson there joining us. Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador to the UN says the U.S. cannot advance its agendas by keeping oppressive sanctions against Tehran. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said that 2 months into the U.S. president, new U.S. president Joe Biden's term, Washington is still in violation of the Iran nuclear deal and UN Security Council Resolution 2231, which endorses it. He blamed Biden for pressing ahead with his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran while admitting its failure. Dr. Avanchi was responding to comments made by the U.S. Secretary of State that Antony Blinken had once again asked Iran to take the first step to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal. Here he is.
I had a meeting last night with our E3 partners, with the U.K., with Germany and France. We are all very much on the same page when it comes to Iran, when it comes to our common interest in seeing if Iran wants to engage in diplomacy to come back fully into compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA. We are, again, prepared to engage on that. to date, Iran has not been, but let's see what happens in the weeks ahead.
Robin Hemings.
Antony Blinken said the ball is in Tehran's court to revive the accord. He also called for a new strong deal, which can include Iran's ballistic missile program, accusing the Islamic Republic of destabilizing the region. Iran has always stressed the existing nuclear agreement is non-negotiable. Iran's leader has also reiterated the country will not return to full compliance with the accord unless the U.S. lifts all sanctions. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has said that Washington's promises have no credibility. Iran began to reduce commitments under the pact a year after the former U.S. administration walked away from it in May of 2018. And political commentator Nick Ayala joined us earlier with his take on the story.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party, and not just the Democrats, but all of the politicians in the United States. Like you mentioned, at one point, a year ago, they were out there criticizing Donald Trump for pulling out of the JCPOA. Now they are, and they ran a campaign really pushing for the renegotiation of the Iran nuclear deal. But what we're seeing now is what's interesting is now you have many Republicans, part of the GOP, as well as even some Democrats who are now calling on Joe Biden not to rejoin or not to renegotiate the JCPOA. And that's, that just goes to show that at the end of the day, it was never really about trying to find some sort of dialogue or cooperation between the U.S. and Iran for many of these politicians. What it was about was enacting U.S. imperialism and the fear that Donald Trump was not following or towing the line of U.S. imperialist policy. So now all these Democrats and even some conservatives went after him, attacking him, saying that he's not doing what you should be doing, what the established political operatives are already doing, following through with the deal. Rather, he's going against it. Now they want to go against it because they realize that, it's in their interest to be against any sort of collaborative efforts with Iran or any sort of dialogue.
Now, Palestinians say that they do not believe Israel's parliamentary election will change a regime's antagonistic policies towards them. We discussed the matter in detail with our guests in our news review program just a bit earlier. Here it is. And now Palestinian groups and factions are reacting to the results of Israel's general election, holding out little hope for a change in the regime's policies.
The results of the Israeli Knesset election show once again the continuous shift in the social and political institutions of Israel toward the extreme right. This means the policy of denying the rights of our people, as well as the attempt to trample on these rights and an intention to increase the challenges facing Palestinian people.
Hazem Qasem called on Palestinians to adopt a united policy to confront increasing Israeli extremism. Palestinian political faction, the Fatah, said the issue of Palestine has not been on the agenda of the Israeli election and call for unity among Palestinians. Also, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammad Shataya, said a future Israeli Prime Minister must end the occupation of Palestinian territories. He, however, expressed regret that Tel Aviv is shifting to the extreme right. The comments come as Israel has held a fourth general election in 2 years amid a spiraling political deadlock. Partial results show no clear path to victory for any Israeli parties. And now joining us for this news review is John Philpott, international lawyer at the ICC, joining us from Montreal, and Miko Pellet, author and peace activist, joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we will start there with John Philpott in Montreal. John, your initial thoughts on the Israeli elections and what Palestinians should respect as a result of it?
Well, I don't see it as any significant change. I'm not an expert on internal politics in Israel, but we know that the Labor Party and Gantz were terrible in 2014 in Gaza. And Israeli policy with respect to its neighbors has not changed. With respect to Iran has not changed. We see the region as, if anything, getting worse with the intensification of the American occupation of Syria, the war on Syria. I understand there's a new base going to be constructed in Jordan. So I don't see any shift in the politics of the region. We're aware of the conflicts with the shipping on the near Palestine, Israel. And so I don't see this as a big change. And it's up to the Palestinian political nation to decide on its future, but I don't see a change. From our end in Canada or in the West, we want to continue with BDS to allow the Palestinian people the right of return, equality, and the end to the occupation. And this is what I think is important.
Go ahead.
And some people are concerned about the shift to the extreme right. I'm not sure, with respect to the occupation, the center, the left, and the right are pretty much indistinguishable. And I would like to hear my colleague, who's going to be speaking in a few minutes, who knows internal politics of Israel better than me, and wonder whether it will be a change.
Thank you, John. And Miko Pellet, we have you on a phone, I've learned. Welcome to the program, but your initial thoughts on the story.
Sure, these elections have nothing to do with change. It's just about the last four elections are part of Netanyahu's strategy to remain in power. It has nothing to do with change. I mean, it was obvious, I think, from the get-go that he was going to win. In the last election, there was a moment there where it seemed like he might actually have lost, that he was going to be unseated. But through his own political maneuvers and the weakness of the opposition parties, he was able to maneuver them to allow him to continue to be prime minister, and then actually go back on their word to the voters and the whole coalition that was built in order to defeat him fell apart. So he was able to do all of that in the last election. And in this election, there was no real threat to his seat. There was no real opposition to him. Everybody running against him are only doing so because they want a piece of the pie. They want to get a good portfolio. They know that they can't beat him, but they can perhaps negotiate a good seat at the table, and that's really what it's all about. This is a strategy of Netanyahu to remain in power. It has nothing to do with any kind of change. Now, it is true that there are certain elements on the right, on the extreme right, that have been strengthened. And we have to understand that while the majority of Israeli politics agrees on the issue of Palestine, that there should be no compromise, that the whole country belongs to Israel and so forth, that Palestinians have no rights or space within that country, these particular elements that have just gotten stronger, their agenda is to destroy Al-Aqsa. Their agenda is to destroy the Dome of the Rock and build some kind of a temple there. So I think those elements have been strengthened, and I think the push to go in that direction, to get rid of more Palestinians out of Jerusalem, and eventually to get to a point where they have more control in Al-Aqsa and are able to destroy it and build their own kind of temple there, I think those elements have gotten stronger, and that is a very grave concern.
Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. John Pilpot, they're joining us from Montreal, and Miko Pellet, they're joining us from Washington, D.C. Now, Britain and the European Union say that they're looking for a win-win scenario to resolve a row over COVID vaccines. In a joint statement, the UK government and the European Commission said that they've been discussing ways to ensure a reciprocally beneficial relationship. Two sides vowed to expand vaccine supplies to all their citizens. The statement came after the EU tightened controls on vaccine exports amid a third wave of the pandemic. and the bloc threatened to ban exports to countries like the UK, which have higher vaccination rates, but they're not exporting their shots to the European Union. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that blockades of vaccines or medicines are not sensible and will deter investment. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes says a row over vaccine supplies could further strain relations between the EU and UK.
It has to be said that in all of this, you could argue that all sides are correct and all sides are wrong in terms of which elements you look at. Now, certainly we cannot, and no journalist can get the data to suggest that Britain has exported vaccines to the European Union. However, we do know for certain that the EU has exported 10 million vaccines of AstraZeneca to the UK. So the EU side is saying, look, if this situation continues where we're exporting vaccines to the UK and we're not getting anything back, you know, there has to be a block on this at some point. So where does that leave us? Well, we could see a situation that the relations could deteriorate even further between the EU and the UK. Now, we're going to have more on this in the next 24 hours. On Thursday and Friday, EU leaders will meet via video conference. They'll have a summit. And in fact, President Joe Biden will take part in that as well. And it'll be dominated by the subject of vaccines.
Brazil's health ministry says that the country's death toll from COVID-19 has passed the grim milestone of 300,000 as a deadly surge in cases has pushed hospitals to the brink. And the announcement came after the country registered around 90,000 new infections and over 2,000 new deaths, and that's all over the past day. The South American country has registered around 12.2 million infections. Brazil is the second worst hit country after the U.S. to pass that bleak milestone. Currently, one in four global fatalities is Brazilian. Observers blame the surge on a patchy vaccine rollout, a highly contagious new variant, and lack of nationwide restrictions. Country's new health minister has pledged, though, a vaccination goal of 1 million shots a day to put brakes on the crisis. U.S. President Joe Biden has named Vice President Kamala Harris to lead efforts with Mexico and Central American governments to try to stem the flow of migrants into America.
The vice presidents agreed, among the multiple other things that have happened in the meeting, and I appreciate it, agreed to lead our diplomatic effort and work with those nations to accept the returnees and enhance migration enforcement at their borders, So many folks.
And Biden announced the move at a White House meeting of his immigration team. He said the U.S. is going to need help from Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Decision comes as Biden faces increasing criticism over his policy on immigration. He blamed an escalating migration challenge on what he called somewhat draconian policies of his predecessor, Donald Trump. The U.S. has seen record numbers of arrivals at its borders in recent months after the new U.S. administration eased some restrictions. Change has led to overcrowded facilities and a humanitarian crisis at the southern border. That's it for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye for now.
Hello.
Congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight. 21 state attorneys general are suing Biden administration, saying that the president exceeded his authority in halting production of the Keystone XL pipeline by executive order earlier this year. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading 21 states sue Biden in attempt to revive Keystone Pipeline. Here's more on that. State attorneys general are suing the Biden administration, alleging that the president exceeded his authority in halting production of the Keystone XL pipeline by executive order earlier this year. The lawsuit, led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and Montana Attorney General Austin Kinson, was filed recently at a federal district court in Texas. The suit argues that Biden does not have the authority to halt the pipeline project through executive order, and that only legislation passed by Congress can create such a decree. Revocation of the Keystone XL pipeline permit is a regulation of interstate and international commerce, which can only be accomplished, as any other statute can, through the process of bicameralism and presentment, the lawsuit states. The president lacks the power to enact his ambitious plan to reshape the economy in defiance of Congress' unwillingness to do so. The lawsuit further alleges that the states involved in it stand to lose substantial tax benefits that would have helped poorer rural areas. The pipeline has been halted before, when the Obama administration issued a similar executive order stopping its production. Former President Donald Trump revived the pipeline's construction in 2019. Biden's executive order ending it once again came about the same day that he was sworn in office earlier this year. Biden claimed authority to end the pipeline by citing a presidential permit that had been signed by his predecessor. The permit is hereby revoked in accordance with Article 1 of the permit, the executive order read. Ending the pipeline was important to address the long-term effects of climate change and to begin the process of transitioning toward a clean energy economy, Biden order said. Leaving the Keystone XL pipeline permit in place would not be consistent with my administration's economic and climate imperatives, he said. While several states are arguing in favor of resuming the pipeline, indigenous water protectors in states like Minnesota want to see more pipeline projects ended as well, such as the Enbridge Line 3 replacement and expansion plan. Earlier this week, Enbridge officials announced a temporary halt to the Line 3 project due to seasonal restrictions. Work is slated to begin again around June 1st. Indigenous activists and community leaders are demanding that Governor Tim Walz, Minnesota Democratic former Labor Party, issue an executive order ending the pipeline, as the court considers litigation regarding its continued construction. Enbridge is now furiously constructing the pipeline, literally at five separate locations, in an effort to construct as much of the pipeline as possible before the appellate court considers the substantive issues of the appeal, Robert Larson chairman of the Minnesota Indiana First Council, wrote in a letter to Waltz last month. The attorneys general say Congress should have the final say on the project. Attorneys general from 21 states sued to overturn President Joe Biden's cancellation of the contentious Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada. Led by Ken Paxton of Texas and Austin Kenston of Montana, the state said Biden had overstepped his authority when he revoked the permit for the Keystone pipeline on his first day in office. Because the line would run through multiple U.S. states, Congress should have the final say over whether it's built, according to the lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court in Texas. Construction on the 1,200-mile, that is about 1,930-kilometer pipeline, began last year when former President Donald Trump revived the long-delayed project after it had stalled under Obama administration. It would move up to 830,000 barrels, that is about 35 million gallons of crude daily, from the oil and fields of western Canada to Steele City, Nebraska, where it would connect to other pipelines that feed oil refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Biden canceled its permit over long-standing concerns that burning oil sands crude would make climate change worse. Some moderate Democratic lawmakers also have urged Biden to reverse his decision, including senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and John Tester of Montana. Other states joining in on the lawsuit includes attorneys general from Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام اتق الله بعض التقى وإن قل واجعل بينك وبين الله سترا وإن رق.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "Fear Allah to some degree, even though it be little, and set a curtain between you and Allah, even though it be thin."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. One of the profound lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, is the concept of bravery and valor. As both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, as well as Shia and Sunni scholars, have all unanimously attested to the fact that in his time, Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most courageous and the most brave and valorous person. Along with the many traditions about the valor and bravery of Imam Ali alayhi salam on the battlefield and off the battlefield, we find that one day the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam came out with a very happy manner, and he said to his companions, "I am a valorous man, the son and brother of valorous men." And then the Holy Prophet continued and he said, "The reason for my being valorous is that I am the master and the leader of the Arabs." And then he says, "As for being the son of a valorous father, I am the son of Abraham, Ibrahim, the friend of Allah, Khalilullah, a prophet about whom Allah has said, 'A young man making mention of them and he was called Abraham. And then the prophet said, as for being the brother of a valorous man, I am the brother of Ali, about whom Gabriel, Jibrail, has said, there is no man more valorous than Ali. Dear friends, it is an attested and unanimous fact among both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, as well as among both Sunnis and Shias, that Imam Ali alayhi salam was truly a very courageous, brave, and valorous person. But when we look deeper into the traditions which are related by Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that he has told us, the most courageous and valorous of people is the one who fights against their sins. Fighting against one's sins, the most valorous and brave of actions, a beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajab Ali.
Listen to this wisdom, brothers and sisters. Imam Ali alayhi salam says to his son, I know I don't usually like to read, because I find when I read something, I disconnect from the crowd. But I want you to think of what I'm saying. Please reflect on it, and I will end soon. He said, this is an advice from a father who realizes the mortality of life, who is getting old, who has patiently borne reverses and calamities, who hates the worldly desires and has overcome them, and who is going shortly to pass out of this world. What a letter he's writing to his son, Imam Hassan. Of course, this will is for you and me. Imam Ali says, my dear son, you are part of my body and my soul, and whenever I look at you, I feel as if I am looking at myself. This is Imam Ali talking to his son. If any calamity happens to you, it has befallen me. Look at what he gives him. He said, my first and foremost advice to you is to fear Allah. Fear here in a positive way. Be aware of him. Be his obedient servant. Keep his thought always fresh in your mind. Be attached to and carefully guard the rope of Islam, which connects you with him. Can any other connection be stronger, more durable, and more lasting than this command? No. This is a father talking to a son. Those of us who are going to be fathers, those of us who are fathers, this is how we should be talking to our sons. He says, oh my son, this is now the title, how to gain experience and how to build character. He says to him, accept good advices and freshen your mind with them. Adopt piety and kill your inordinate desires. Do not talk about things which you do not know. Do not speculate and pass judgment over subjects about which you are not in position to form an opinion and are not called upon to do so. Meaning, know your balance. Don't give comments to people or say things that you don't know about. It doesn't belong to you. Look at an advice. He's talking to an imam, talking to an imam. He says, give up the way where there is a possibility of you going astray, where there is a danger of you wandering the wilderness of ignorance, possibility of losing the sight of the goal which you want to attain. Give it up. Don't go towards it. Advise people to do good and live virtuously, because you are fit to give such advices. Let your words and deeds teach the world lessons of how to abstain from wickedness and villainous. Try your best to keep away from those who indulge in vices and evil deeds. Meaning, keep away from them. Don't associate with them.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Mitsubishi Corporation, its Japanese engineering affiliate, Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Scott Foster, an analyst with Lightstream Research, Tokyo, entitled Japan Incorporation Driving Towards the Hydrogen Energy Future. The article was published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. When Warren Buffett's investment company, Berkshire Hathaway, announced last August that it had acquired more than 5% of the five largest Japanese general trading companies, including Mitsubishi Corporation, Itochu, Mitsui & Co., Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corporation, most failed to notice that Buffett was buying into coal-fired power projects. Within 3 months, a group of institutional investors led by Nordi Asset Management of Finland sent a letter to Mitsubishi Corporation requesting that it abandon its Vang Ang 2 coal-fired power plant project in Vietnam. Friends of the Earth, Greta Thunberg, and Japanese environmentalists piled on, but to no avail. However, in February, Mitsubishi Corporation announced its withdrawal from the Vinh Thanh 3 coal-fired power plant project, also in Vietnam, and said that Vang Ang 2 would be its last such project. Both Itochu and Mitsui & Co. have also announced plans to exit thermal coal. Marubeni and Sumitomo Corp. plan to do so except in cases when no other source of power is available and where the most advanced emission reduction technologies are used. So, what will they do instead? These are large companies with annual turnover ranging from $48 billion to $146 billion before and presumably after the COVID-19 pandemic, operating in a wide range of businesses from resources and energy to infrastructure, industry, IT, and finance. They have no shortage of projects, and they're all involved in hydrogen energy. For example, Mitsubishi Corp., its Japanese engineering affiliate Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. Itochu plans to build one of the world's largest liquid hydrogen plants in Japan with Air Liquide to supply fuel cell vehicles. Air Liquide already operates hydrogen fueling stations in Japan. Mitsui & Co. has entered into an agreement with Hiringa Energy to pursue commercial hydrogen energy projects in New Zealand. It has also invested $25 million in First Element Fuel, the largest developer and operator of hydrogen stations in California. Marubeni is working with Siemens and Master to develop hydrogen and other alternative energy technologies in Abu Dhabi. Sumitomo Corp. and Japanese engineering company JGC are planning to build a facility in Australia that would produce hydrogen using solar-powered electrolysis. These and many other Japanese companies are also getting involved in hydrogen energy through consortia and industry associations. Recently, the Hydrogen Energy Supply Chain, HECS, pilot project in Victoria, Australia, announced that the world's first coal-to-hydrogen production process had begun operations. The HESC project is being implemented by a consortium, including from Japan, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, J-Power, Gas Distributor, Iwatani, Marconi, and Sumitomo Corp, supported by the Victorian, Australian, and Japanese governments. Last October, the Japan Hydrogen Association was established by Mitsui & Co., Iwatani, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, Japanese Oil and Energy Company, ENEOS, Coop Steel, Mitsui Financial Group, Kansai Electric Power, and Toshiba. It aims to form international alliances and develop global hydrogen supply chains. In December, those companies were joined by Toyota and shipping company K-Line. In addition, K-Line, Iwatani, Kansai Electric Power, Nomura Shipbuilding, the Development Bank of Japan, and Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology have formed a group to promote hydrogen fuel cell-powered ships. Maro Beni is also leading the COP Kansai Hydrogen Utilization Council, which aims to develop a regional hydrogen supply chain in West Central Japan. The council includes many of the companies listed above, plus power plant equipment maker Mitsubishi Power, general contractor Obayashi, and Shell Japan. The Japanese are keen on industry associations, which often overlap. It sounds bureaucratic, but ensures a degree of coordination that would be hard to achieve otherwise, as well as logistical and financial support for worldwide operations. Iwatani recently announced plans to produce hydrogen with Stanwell Corporations in Queensland, Australia, and to build 7 new hydrogen fueling stations in California with Toyota. With interest high in Toyota's latest developments in hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles, it's worth pointing out that Honda and Nissan also make hydrogen FCEVs. Toyota began financing the construction of hydrogen fueling stations for passenger cars and other vehicles in California in 2014. Honda quickly followed suit. Toyota, Honda, and Nissan have been supporting the development of hydrogen station infrastructure in Japan since 2015. ENEOS now plans to install hydrogen pumps at its gas stations, a first for Japan and one that points toward a nationwide build-out. ENEOS operates some 13,000 service stations from Hokkaido to Okinawa. Available data show that there are now some 135 hydrogen fueling stations in Japan, 150-plus in Europe, more than half of them in Germany, about 80 in North America, more than half of them in California, and more than 70 in China. The list of hydrogen power applications continues to grow. Buses powered by Toyota hydrogen fuel cells are being introduced in Japan and Portugal. East Japan railway company Hitachi and Toyota are working on train engines powered by hydrogen fuel cells and storage batteries, and construction equipment maker Komatsu plans to develop hydrogen-powered mining trucks. There are questions about hydrogen energy, most of them having to do with its relatively high cost, how it can be transported efficiently and safely, and the potentially negative environmental consequences of hydrogen production. All of these problems are currently the subject of research and feasibility studies. Hydrogen fuel is currently several times more expensive than gasoline, but the price should come down as the volume produced and sold goes up. which will happen as Japan moves from 135 hydrogen stations now to several thousands in ENEOS network alone. Transport is made economical by liquefaction and compression. Scott Foster wrote, as with gasoline, safety is a matter of pipe, tank, and fueling system engineering. At one trade show I attended in the United States, an industry representative explained that this company's hydrogen fuel tank could withstand an attack by 50 caliber machine gun. Hidden environmental costs are a concern with most, if not all, alternatives to fossil fuels. In the case of hydrogen, the issues getting the most attention are the source of energy for electrolysis and potential carbon emissions from the coal to hydrogen production process. The former is easily monitored. The latter will either be dealt with efficiently or the technology will fail economically as well as politically. As for competition, KMPG's Global Automotive Executive Survey of 2017 found that 78% of 1,000 senior auto executives asked thought that hydrogen FCEVs would eventually outperform battery-powered EVs. Elon Musk is not one of them, but Toyota, Honda, and Nissan are pursuing both battery and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Some industry observers believe that the cost of new technology and infrastructure will prove to be too high, but both government support and the long, but incomplete list of companies mentioned in this article suggests otherwise. In any case, Warren Buffett investments have done well so far. As of March 12, the share prices of Japan's five biggest trading companies were up 45% to 99% from their 52-week lows.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.